Okay, so we're doing week three of looking at the book and concepts and bridging the gap. And I want to start with a review from last week. So did anybody do any kind of thinking or review on their own during the week, or is everybody just too busy to process and this is the space? Just so I know.
I did a little reading.
Yeah? Good. Okay, fine. So let's start with a review. It's a lot. It's good to read it at home if you can. And if not, I totally understand how everybody is way overprogrammed these days. Okay, so just a quick review of vocabulary terms from last week. So we're doing a review. Review is chazara. So that means review. Hasmada or hatmada is diligence or intense learning. Zichuch harayon. So that's 2 weeks worth of words just because it's an important one. Clarifying the idea. We talked a little bit about verbal introspection and what that's like, kind of a talking to yourself type of thing. And a chazara exercise, which I don't think we really did go into last week, but how to use that verbal talking as a chazara exercise, which maybe we'll get to this week and maybe not. We talked about sechel and ratzon. So for purposes of this review, and then we're going to go a little bit further this week, seichel is the intellect, ratzon is the will. We talked about how they pull in different directions sometimes. Ratzon is the drive to get things done, and seichel has to hold it back sometimes or direct it. So if ratzon is the force that drives one, but it's the interest. Ratzon is interest or desire. So that's a driving force, and intellect should be the driver, really. Should channel where it goes. Pashut means simple. When we talked about the concept of simple, not simplistic. So it doesn't mean that something has to get to a simplistic level, but in understanding something and trying to make it pashut, we want to make it so that it's so clear. So I'll give you an example which might help with the so clear. Because sometimes you just hear things and they make total sense just because it's what you know, but you didn't really phrase it that way. So what would you say shapes you more, nature or nurture?
Depends.
Right, so it's a controversy, and it does depend. It's been a long discussion over several decades, and actually the question is asked out of an incorrect paradigm. We as Jews don't believe that you're shaped by nature or nurture, but you're shaped by free will. That the question, are you shaped more by nature or nurture, is really a deterministic view, rather than you having responsibility for how you shape yourself, right? So that we may be influenced by nature and nurture to different degrees and at different times, but really what we're shaped by is our choices, right? So that's very clear. Now that concept is pashut, really, to think about it. Everybody kind of in this room knew that, just maybe didn't phrase it that way, but we're not determined by our nature. We are not the unbridled expression of our genetics, and we are not the whole expression of our entire environment either. We're a combination of both, but we make choices within that. And so we are who we choose to be, or we are the conglomeration of the choices that we've made our entire life. And we'll continue to shape ourselves according to the choices that we make. Those choices may be influenced by both genetics and our environment, but neither one is the determining force. When we say we're a product of either nature or nurture, so that deterministic view takes away human responsibility for making choices. And that's how you get stuff like the Twinkie defense and the, you know, road rage and all that kind of stuff. I mean, what is that? I'm asking everybody to sit more here so I can have a chummier group. You guys could sit here if you want. Next to each other. I put the chairs for the next shy people who walk in, so I know you're not shy, but you're a little more shy, but you
yes,
can sit right here.
I always end up right at the front.
That's what Rabbi Feldheim says. You have to come early to get a seat in the back. That's just the way it is.
So way less shy as time goes on.
Good. Excellent. Okay, so that's just an example of something that can become, it's not a simple concept. It's not a simplistic concept. That's actually a pretty deep concept, and yet it's now more pashut, and you can turn it over and turn it over inside yourself, but hopefully it was a good enough example that most of you can see how something can be simple, pashut, but not simplistic. This is not a simplistic concept at all. It really is a deeper concept of what shapes us, and yet there's a simplicity in understanding it, once you understand it on that higher level of we are products of our free will, not of the other two determining forces, or that they're not. Okay, that's the review. Now, two phrases that I want to talk about first. So spoken words awaken the heart. It's a phrase that I saw today in the Sefer HaChinuch, a class that I'm teaching in the Book of Education. So I'm teaching a class in the 613 mitzvot, and today we examine the mitzvah of recounting the Exodus from Egypt. So in that mitzvah, it reviews the whole Haggadah. But it says there that even if you're by yourself, even if you don't have children, the words in the Torah that say, and you shall speak this, you shall tell this story to your son on that day. It doesn't mean you have to have a son to tell the story to, or a child at all. You have to tell the story, and even if you're by yourself alone, you have to tell the story out loud. Why? Because words awaken the heart. So it's not enough to sit and read the Haggadah alone or to meditate on it. It actually has to be spoken out loud. So there is this concept of speaking things out loud, actually bringing them out of our mouths, because that brings the physical and the spiritual and the breath. So breath is neshima in Hebrew, and it sounds a lot like neshama, right? Mind bringing a chair around here so everybody's kind of closer? You can take one of these chairs and just, sit right there. Great. Yeah. There or there, whatever, just so that you're not at that table, so that I'm trying to get everybody a little chummier. Thank you. So speaking words uses the body and the intellect and the breath all together. So it is bringing together different forces in a person, but the actual speaking out loud of something is an important pathway for awakening the heart or for creating thought and instilling it in ourselves. So I just wanted to bring that concept. And now to deepen our concept of sechel and ratzon, so we can go a little bit deeper there, I want to tell you this phrase that you've probably heard before. And I wrote it in Hebrew, in English letters, just because it's often mistranslated. So I'll translate it in the way you probably have heard it, and then we'll talk about the actual translation. So, barati yetzer, uvarati Torah tavlin. I created a yetzer hara, and I created the Torah as the antidote. Have you ever heard that phrase before? So, that's a completely incorrect translation, what I just said. That's the way it's often translated, okay? Barati yetzer, I created a yetzer. That yetzer is not said yetzer hara or yetzer tov, just yetzer. I created a yetzer. Uvarati Torah tavlin, and I created the Torah as a tavlin. What's a tavlin? Does anybody know? Spice. Good. Torah is a spice. So you have to think about, what is a spice? What function does spice have in food? It enhances it, right? Or it can bring out the flavor in it. So for this purpose, for the purposes of this, we're going to talk about how it brings out the flavor. In a way, it directs the flavor. And you can take the same piece of meat and spice it in different ways and make it taste Sephardic, or make it taste blah, or make it taste sweet. So it could be Hungarian flavored or Moroccan flavored. It depends on the spices. The spices direct the flavor of the meat. So let's think about this. A yetzer. What is a yetzer? A yetzer is a drive. And we usually talk about a negative drive and a positive drive, something that brings us in either direction. But really, there's just one yetzer. The question is, which direction do we go with it? That's how it becomes positive or negative. I think this probably dovetails with what Dr. Mashori just said, right? Just by looking at his syllabus and with what you know, of course. So, but this concept is, I created a drive, and then I created the Torah as the spice. So if you want to direct that drive, the spice of Torah is what's going to help you direct it, right? So without a drive, you can't go anywhere. So now back to our thoughts of ratzon and sechel. So without ratzon, there's no reason to get up in the morning. You have to desire something, or you're not going to go. You have to, I sometimes use, we have a concept to use your yetzer hara to help your yetzer tov. Right? So my yetzer tov is, I want to get up right away. That's the first halacha in Shulchan Aruch. It says, get up right away. Right? And so it says that on the first page. You should be strong like a lion and get up right away. So how do you do that? And not hit the snooze button, but get up right away, right? So that's a commitment that I have. Get up right away. If I wake up earlier than I'm supposed to, then I allow myself to stay in bed until the time that I decided I'm getting up, but I get up exactly at that time, or try to. Right? So what about when you don't feel like it? Right? So then you can use your Yetzer Hara to help you with your Yetzer Tov. Right? So Yetzer Hara is, I like cake. I don't like sweet cake. I like muffin cake. Right? So if I have cake for breakfast, that helps me get up right away. Right? So I know that's not the right breakfast to eat. I should choose something healthier. But it helps me get out of bed if I know, oh, I have pumpkin chocolate chip muffins that I made. They're downstairs. And if I get up right away, I could go get them. So I can use my Yetzer Hara to help jumpstart my Yetzer Tov. So you need to have some rut zone. So sometimes the rut zone, the desire to keep halacha, to do the right thing, is sometimes overwhelmed by the physical. But then you could pull something physical out to help you. Say, I have this desire, but I need the augmenting push of something yummy to eat to get me out of bed. Or whatever it is. You're interested in the headlines or want to check your emails and you don't have a palm, so you can't do it in bed. So you can use it. So the question is, how do you use this yetzer? You have this yetzer. You have the rut zone. The rut zone is what drives you. But the question is, what direction do you drive it? So rut zone, unbridled, can get you into lots of trouble. You need sechel to guide it. But sechel won't get you anywhere without a drive. Right? So Torah without a yetzer won't take you anywhere either. You have to want to live a life. You have to want to create. You have to want to have a family. And you have to want to earn some kind of income so you can get some kind of stuff. And then your innate desires, it always amazes me as I walk past different businesses, somebody wanted to be a shoemaker. He learned the business and he opened up. We don't see that so much here. But in Israel, they have these little kiosks, right, with the shoemakers in there. And they fix shoes and they put in zippers or whatever it is. They sell you shoelaces. And somebody wanted that job. And they learned how to do it so they could have that job. And somebody else wants to be in high tech, and somebody else wanted to be a banker, and somebody else probably, maybe they fell into it, but maybe they wanted to be a garbage man. Who knows? I know my husband, that's what he wanted when he was a little boy. He thought that was the coolest job, to ride on the back of the truck. So maybe somebody kept that in mind. But there's all these, we have so many different drives, and that's what keeps society going, is everybody's drive to make some money for their family, make something for themselves, and so they do what needs to be done to get that. So we need the Yetzer, but we need the Torah as the tavlin, not as the antidote. That's why I don't like that translation. To say I created a Yetzer Hara and I created the Torah as the antidote, so that means you're fighting all the time rather than directing, rather than spicing your life, rather than taking it and enhancing who you are, your drive, and moving it in the direction that you want it to go with the Torah. So that phrase I just wanted to bring out. So Yetzer then is the drive to move. And Yetzer is a little bit different than Ratzon. Ratzon is the desire, but Yetzer is the driving force that makes you go. So now let's look at Seichel again. Seichel part B. Okay, so we said before Seichel is the intellect. So here I'm going to say Seichel is a little deeper. Seichel is the conduit through which we can have a relationship with Torah and Hashem. So that is really the definition in our reading. Let's see if I can find what he talks about there. Got stapled on the wrong side. Or how did this go here? I'm going to use my book instead of the handout. So on page 41, well, let's look at page 40, and we'll just read what the Ramchal has to say about Seichel. Page 40, if you can find it. You have that's unstapled, so that should work too. Oh, here's a stapled one. Okay. So in the italics, this we must see. Both were created simultaneously, the seichel of man and the Torah, which enlightens the seichel. Scripture states in Mishlei, and the Torah is light. The Torah is true light, and not just wisdom alone. In other words, not that Torah is merely analogous to light, but that in itself is actual, that it in itself is actually true light. This is its core reality in the heavenly realms. When Torah enters the soul, it fills it with light, just as the sun's rays illuminate a darkened house. Torah is similarly comparable to fire. Let's see, I want to read all this, but do I want to? Oh, we'll reread it now, and we'll talk about it in a minute. When a hot coal is left untouched, its inner flame is veiled and confined. But if the coal is blown upon, the flame expands igniting and spreading outward. The burning ember then reveals variegated shades that were previously unseen. So it is with the Torah, for its every word and letter is like a burning coal. If we leave them untouched, they will seem like lifeless lumps of coal. We will never realize that they contain within them a burning fire, and they will become almost extinguished. But if we toil over them, we will see every letter ignite into a glittering flame with numerous shades as the wisdom concealed within them is revealed. So it is with the seichel of man. It too has tremendous potential. If it is allowed to ignite with the power of hisponenus, which we will get to, deep thought or introspection. Thus, man's task is to become a misbonane, which we'll get to. And let's look at the next one in quotes here in italics. The Rambam writes, the seichel granted to us by Hashem is the medium of connection between him and us. The option is ours. If we want, we can strengthen this bond. Conversely, we can weaken it little by little until it's lost. So in this section, he's really going deeper into what seichel actually is. That's not just the intellect or the ability to think, but if you think about it, human beings are the only ones with seichel, right? Whether that means common sense, because dogs don't have common sense either. Excuse me, and certainly trees don't. We're the only living things with seichel. But it's more than sense, and it's more than intellect. What it actually is the ability to enter into relationships by our free will. The ability to discern and derive and turn over and go in deeper and roll around in our minds. That's what seichel is. And it's only through that that we can actually have a relationship with Hashem. Or learn Torah, or go deeper inside ourselves. That self-awareness is in the seichel. So there are some animals with some measure of self-awareness. I think elephants have some. I'm not sure, but I think they have, I don't know, some animals see themselves in a mirror and recognize that. But most don't. But even if they do, it's nothing like human seichel. There's nothing that compares to human seichel, to have that conduit. And we do have a concept that animals can have a relationship with God, but it's through instinct. It's not through seichel. It's not through this quality of the intellect where they can think about something, contemplate it, learn more about it, derive concepts from what they learned on their own without getting that information from the outside, starting with outside information, bringing it inside and growing it. That's seichel. And it's only through that conduit that we can have a relationship with God. Do you have a question so far? Anybody? Or a thought?
We never have a relationship with man or woman. Could we ever have a relationship with God just by the Torah?
That's a good question. So if we've never experienced a relationship with a human being, if we're born into a library, right, or a place there after we were weaned, right, and we just had books to read our whole life and somebody put food under the door, could we have a relationship with God?
Through the Torah.
it's a good question. Likely, yes. And yet, the world is created in order to create the environment in which we learn what we need to learn in order to have relationships, in order to have the relationship with God. So, for instance, we have the concept that where it says in the Torah, honor your father and your mother. So, we don't have to do that because we have a father and a mother who gave us so much. We have a father and a mother so that we can keep that mitzvah. So there are a lot of mitzvahs that you can't keep without relationships with others, and you can't really, with our minds, the way that they're structured right now, can't really understand relationship without the relationships that we have. So going into a marriage relationship or thinking about a friendship relationship or thinking about a parent-child relationship, thinking about the unconditional love that sometimes becomes conditional in parent-child can help us understand relationship of God to us. And then the lover relationship of marriage can help us understand a parallel relationship of God to us. So it might be difficult. I don't know. It might be difficult to be able to have a deep relationship with God in a vacuum without having the parables of other relationships in our lives. But it's probably possible. But it would be a different relationship for sure.
We don't know what was going to happen with Adam and Eve if they hadn't flunked the test immediately. And what if they were going to have children or not. They didn't need the Torah, we know.
Correct.
So there was nobody. I guess they were going to have a relationship with one another. And there would be giving between them. But I mean, it was purely a relationship, for the most part, between them and God.
Right, but
and
they had
didn't need all those mitzvahs.
It didn't. That's correct.
Have to, you know, in the example Jesse.
Right, so that's correct. In Plan A, before we were transformed, because it wasn't Adam and Eve, a guy in this room and a girl in this room who are just on a higher level or fresher or without the baggage or the history, that were the ones that were created. It was a vastly different type of human being that we can't really conceive of before the sin. So that human being that was there before the sin was a light body. A body made out of light, kind of like if you ever used to watch Casper the Friendly Ghost and only the concept of like television ghosts that are light, that you can see through, that can go through walls. I don't know about the going through wall part, but the lightness of it. So light is still physical, but it's not as heavy as this fleshy body that I'm in right now. So the light body was exchanged, light in Hebrew is or, with an aleph. And once we did that sin, we were covered with or, with an ayin, which is leather or skin, flesh. So our light bodies were exchanged for flesh bodies at the time, and there was a whole contraction of the body and its ability to function as well with that first sin. And that's one reason why Havdalah time, when we say borei morei ha'esh, we are looking at our fingernails, we see the shine in our fingernails and the see-through quality of our fingernails, and it reminds us of that initial body. It wasn't hard like a fingernail, but it was shiny and see-through like that. So that's the thing that we have in our body that can remind us of what that light body was like, and the fire reflecting on it. We say types of fire, because me'orei ha'esh, different types of fire, not just esh. It could just be borei ha'esh. But it's not. It's borei me'orei ha'esh, borei, the one who creates different types of fire. So we are recalling that initial body. So the initial body was different because bodies and souls always go together. So a body has to be created as the physical reality of the best match for the soul, for the soul's best expression through that body. So with the contraction of the body and it's becoming fleshy, the soul also didn't contract, because the soul can't contract, but had boundaries placed on it so that the soul couldn't behave in the way that souls can behave by divine decree in this plane. And we're waiting for our next plane for souls to expand back to where they could be. So that's a complicated question, as you see. The Ramchal in Derech Hashem says that after we shed this body, before the eternal world, in an in-between stage, so while this world still exists, but we're not in it, right? So think about your grandparents right now, and most people's grandparents who aren't around, and everybody who still has them, they should live a long and healthy life. But think about grandparents or great-grandparents who are not here, so where is their soul right now? Their soul is not in Olam Haba yet. Their soul is either reincarnated, so it's right next to you somewhere, or there's what's called a soul holding zone. And that soul holding zone is like a recovery place for souls to take all the spiritual things that they did that should have had a stronger influence on them in this world, but that influence was held back by divine decree, and they're able to recover in that zone where, kind of like when you flick on a fluorescent light, it's not bright yet, and in a few minutes it brightens up. Right? Have you had that experience, right? In a few minutes it brightens up. So that soul recovery zone's like that. You go there with a potential to be brighter than you look like when you arrive. And that potential is actualized there so that you shine to the brightness of what you've accomplished here, and then you wait there until the resurrection. The resurrection is when that stronger soul is placed back into a physical blob, and then the physical blob immediately transconfigurates to represent the spiritual reality of the soul that was placed in it. So at the resurrection, when body and soul are together, we'll be able to see each other's spiritual levels, not like today, where we all look the same. You can't really tell who keeps kosher, who davens, who speaks Lashon Hara, who cheats, who gives a lot of tzedakah. You can't tell by looking at somebody, but you will then. You'll be able to see. The bodies will reflect the soul and what the soul's accomplished. It's kind of a creepy concept. And yet, That is a concept. And in a way, that could be considered part of the fires of Gehenna, because there's no place with fire. But fire burns, and so does shame. So the shame of having revealed who you really are, if you're not who you could have really been, is very painful. So those are some of the thoughts to think about for the future.
So that's the process, this purification process is taking place in the wisdom state. But you described that before Tathiasomnes.
So there's Gehenna, which is a separate process, but maybe part of it. Who knows exactly? You know, is there a zone for Gehenna and a zone for soul recovery? It may be separate places. It may be an integrated process. But there is a process of removing the negativity that the soul has acquired in this world before it goes on to the eternal world. And there can't be going on to the eternal world until this world that we're standing in right now is over. Because you can't judge a person and you can't give final judgment until this world is over. Because everything that I teach my daughter, that she teaches her daughter, that she teaches her daughter, is all accrued to me, positive and negative. So I can be judged when I die right now on what I accomplished in these, hopefully, 120 years. But I accomplished more. There's ripple effects that keep going out through the generations. So I can't be fully judged until the world's done. So none of us can. And that's
that hold true for Moshe and for Abraham? They're not in Olam Haba yet,
right? No, they can't be, because their influence isn't done yet. You know, we just learned the words of the Ramchal and the Rambam just now. So we just elevated their souls. Anything that we do from Mordechai Meshori's class or from this class, because we learn something, even a deeper insight, even something that connects us more, even something that gives us a little more understanding or a little more yira or a little more love of Hashem, anything, eyelash worth to more than that, accrues to them. It accrues to us, but it accrues to them. We just learned their words. They helped us understand it. They're in the grave. And yet, they're influencing our lives today.
So they're still in the holding pattern?
Yes. No, so they're in a holding pattern, but not, because they're elevating in that holding pattern.
I know, but they're what we call that, what did you say?
The soul holding zone, yeah. Kind of. Yeah,
they're there?
So likely they're there, or it's possible, also there's other concepts, that it all goes together. There's no clarity here. It's possible that their soul splintered into many splinters and are here. Okay. Right? I mean, to me it seems like Arya Kaplan was a reincarnation of the Ramchal. And who knows who the Ramchal is a reincarnation of? The Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who wrote things so clearly, was able to explain spiritual concepts with tremendous clarity, and died very young, at 38. A genius, right? So Arya Kaplan also was able to write things with amazing clarity, unparalleled in the English language writers.
That's the first I've heard of that concept.
So we definitely believe in reincarnation. We do see souls that reincarnate. We wonder, and we have some traditions about souls that have reincarnated. Like, for instance, we do have a tradition, which doesn't mean that we have to believe this necessarily, but there is a tradition that the king of Nineveh was Pharaoh. Either that Pharaoh lived for a long time or he reincarnated into the king of Nineveh.
That Abraham, I thought when he went up, he was right up there with God.
Right, so we... So we talk about that, and there is a closeness to God in that place than there is here, certainly, and depending on what somebody's accomplished. So it's very, I mean, how can we understand that? It's like trying to explain to an African villager what this building looks like. You know, and you press a button and the lights go on, and you pull a lever and hot water comes out, and you push another one and all your wastes go away and there's no smell, right? And the rain never gets on you and the wind can't touch you. How do you explain that to somebody who never, ever, 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 ever experienced anything like it? You know, it's just, and we have stuff on the floor that doesn't rot or mold, and it's not a dirt floor, and bugs don't get in the building. And if they do, we chase them out right away. It's nice and sealed. Like, you can't, like, and we could cool it in the summertime. Like, how can you explain that to somebody? It's so, the same way we can't explain to our, it's not possible to explain to us what the next world is like. It's so far outside of our concept. So that's a good segue, actually.
I want to ask about the holding pattern. I like that term, the holding pattern.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now we have these disembodied souls.
we'll call it in the holding zone. Is uh-huh. that a concept, a Jewish concept?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and then there's some indication that these souls somehow, just certain souls might take a quick transit back to Earth and mm-hmm. reincarnate
yes.
themselves, and we'll call it a newborn baby?
Yep.
And what about these souls? Do they have certain characteristics so that we know this happened, or is this speculation, or what is this?
This is Jewish tradition.
Abraham, come on, Arthur.
I'm trying to figure out this holding pattern.
Okay, so there's a few different traditions that we have that go together with this. So one of them is that there's 600,000 Jewish souls.
Okay.
Clearly we've had more than 600,000 Jewish births from the dawn of Jewish history until now.
Okay.
Right? So how is that? We must be recycling souls. And right now we have more than 600,000 Jews alive. How is that? So we must be all soul parts. So there is a concept of soul parts where we don't all have the same soul. So we don't all have a whole soul, but we have a soul piece that we're working on.
So you could say a newborn baby could have composite souls? Is that what we're talking about?
Could have composite souls or splintered souls. A splinter of a soul, not even a whole soul. Because we don't really have a whole soul. There's also the concept of one proto-soul. One soul for all humanity, that's Adam.
Okay.
Adam and Chava together in that one androgynous being before the split, before they were Adam and Chava. See, they split into two, it was one Adam. All humanity has one proto-soul. Then that split into multiple souls. Okay. But then a transition happened where there was a separation from the main soul body of all humanity to create the main soul body of the Jews, which is separate from all of humanity. Okay. And that transition happened through the squeezing out process of Egypt and the absorption process of Mount Sinai. So there was the removing the dross from the soul of this segment of humanity, and then the dross when silver is smelted or ore is taken out of the ground. So what you want is the metal and you don't want the rocks, right? So the bad stuff is the dross and the good stuff is the good stuff, right? So you want to remove the dross. So the impurities, right? So you put it in a smelting pot to remove the impurities. So Egypt is considered the smelting pot, not like America, the melting pot. But the smelting pot where the impurities were removed from this collective soul that we share. And then with those impurities removed, we were then ready to go over to the Sinai experience where more positivity was absorbed. So not only was the negativity removed from our collective soul, but we absorbed a level of positivity that elevated us to a completely different level. So that our soul technically is of a different species than the rest of humanity. Now, that soul, yeah. We are considered a different, like angels are a different species than humans, that we do not believe at all that you know, angels were humans, that humans die and become angels. This is not a Jewish concept. We do believe in angels, but there's no relationship to human beings at all. They're a different species. And so human beings, there's one wide human family, and Jews are actually a different species, subset of that family, but technically, spiritually, a different species.
So where do souls of non-Jewish people go? Are they a different holding pattern?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure.
Can you repeat the question?
Where do the souls of non-Jewish people go? So what is the process after they shed their bodies, and where do they go? Every single human being is created in the image of God. Every single human being, Jew or non-Jew, can create a relationship with God that can make them eternal. God is the only eternal thing. So the only way that we can be eternal is if we attach ourselves to God. Otherwise, we'll be finite if we remain separate from God, because the only thing that's eternal is God. So to the extent that we attach ourselves to God, that's the extent that we get eternality.
That tells me that this holding pattern, the world of souls, not all the souls make it into Olam Haba, because it's not eternal.
Right.
Not everyone is eternal.
That's correct.
Becomes eternal.
That's correct. Not everyone does. Let's say someone doesn't believe in God. So let's get to trickier questions, and then we'll make it a little bit easier just so that it's handleable and swallowable for tonight. So, and you can sleep, okay? Let's say you know somebody who doesn't believe in God and you're worried about them, right? Or you have a close relative that you buried already that doesn't believe in God and now you're worried about them, right? I remember once going to somebody's Shiva and she was crying and crying to me saying, my father didn't believe. He, you know, didn't do anything. And where is he now? And I'm so worried about him. What, you know, what am I supposed to think, right? So we believe in reincarnation. We are only one chapter in a long history of this soul's existence. It is our responsibility to write the best chapter that we can. But we are not the beginning and the end of this piece of this soul. So we do. So you don't have to worry necessarily about that person. And yet, we do want to take responsibility and be the best person that we can be. And especially, I mean, each one of us, and why we all have so much stuff in our lives, and especially today, is we're coming towards the end of history. We're right up close to the end, right before the Messiah comes, within the next, who knows, next year, 50 years, 100 years, but it's close. It's really close. So before that happens, we do have to finish the book on each one of these souls.
And how do you know it's close?
How do we know it's close? That's such a good question, and it's a little longer answer than this class.
The end of time.
It's a really important question. And it definitely should be looked at. And it's just, it's a little bit too long, but I could do that one time with this class. I have a nice walk of history, right? We did that. Didn't you do that with me? With the rope, yeah. Yeah, that's a nice thing to do. So we do have a concept. I mean, just quickly, we have a concept of 6,000 years each year paralleling one of the days of creation, and then an era of Mashiach, the 7,000 years, which parallels Shabbos, and then done. So we are, I mean, just if you look at the time, 5770. We're not actually supposed to do the math, subtracting 5770 from 6,000. It's kind of hard not to do that in our heads when the number is so clean like that. But we're not supposed to do that math. But before that number 6,000 gets here, it's going to happen for sure by then, if not before. So, and then we have that era. But we even see that happening today. I mean, just a tiny, it's not a proof, because there's no proof for any of this. Because if you don't believe it, you don't believe it. You can't prove it. But a thought, piece of the preponderance of evidence that could be added up in somebody who's looking is sixth millennium, which we're in now, parallels the sixth day of creation, right? The sixth day of creation is a Friday, right? Erev Shabbos. What does Erev Shabbos feel like in the morning? In the morning, Erev Shabbos, you have breakfast, you're chatting with people, you might read the paper, whatever, a few phone calls, put in a load of wash. But by lunchtime, you're starting to rev up a little bit. You're not eating lunch usually, Erev Shabbos. You're grabbing a couple of things as you're cooking and preparing. And as you get even closer, everybody's scurrying into the showers. You're trying to get the last thing done. Time speeds up before you light candles. Look at our lives. Every single one of us in this room, we don't have to look past our own lifetimes. Even Elisheva, who's the youngest in the room, doesn't have to look past her own lifetime when she was born to see time speeding up. It's definitely speeding up to a pace that leaves most of us breathless. It was not like that 100 years ago. So, and 100 years ago is not like 200 years ago. And think about 200 years ago, or maybe even, let's go 300 years ago to 3,000 years ago, time was kind of the same, right? It was kind of a similar pace for all those years. But it's from around 300 years ago until now that's just getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster and faster and faster because Erev Shabbos. There's a lot to do before candle lighting. So we're trying to get it done. So yeah.
I just wanted to bring up another concept that the children also can elevate the soul.
Yes, excellent. Thank you very much. So we are all part of one soul. How does that work that the children can elevate? So it is possible that you could do something in the merit of somebody else, or that you do something because you learned it. Like we are elevating the souls of Rambam and Ramchal tonight by learning their material and having it affect us. But that what they taught, they never met us. We're not their children. But what we learn, because they taught it in the world, they published it in a book, and it's taught today, it definitely affects us. So that merit that we generate because of that affects both us. It's the best tiered marketing system possible, right? It affects us and goes straight up the upline to affect Rambam and Ramchal also. But children also can affect. So you can affect the same way, like your parent taught you to give tzedakah. When you give tzedakah, you are affecting your parent. Or, let's say your parent didn't. Your parent was a miser, right? They didn't give tzedakah and they taught you, save all your money, you never know when you're going to need it, right? But you could still say, you know what, I love my parent and I want to generate spiritual merit for them. So I'm going to create a shi'ur, where the merit of the learning goes to them. I'm going to create a tzedakah fund with their name on it, and it's going to go to raise money for poor brides so they can establish a home. And all the merit goes to my parent. So a child can do that for their parent. When they say Kaddish for them, when they do a mitzvah for them, and when they generate other mitzvahs on their behalf, that merit accrues. We are able to just ship that over. How does that work? It's complicated, but one concept that we have to understand is we are one soul. So the concept of all Jews are responsible for each other is not just a family concept. Take care of your brother. Take care of your sister. When your parent says, you'll always be there. And we will always be there for our blood relatives, even if we don't like them so much. You know, a second cousin who calls you up and says, I'm in trouble. Can you help me? Yes, you're my family. I will help you. Right? But it's not just that. It's deeper than that. This is, we are actually one soul. So when we say ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, you should love your neighbor like yourself. Rea is not neighbor. We say that, but shachin is neighbor, right? It should be ve'ahavta l'shchincha kamocha, right? Love your neighbor like yourself. That's not it. It's or fellow. It's not fellow and it's not friend. Rea is from the word trua, the sound of the shofar. That's the staccato note. It means a broken piece. Really. So trua is the broken piece. The root of that is the resh ayin rea. Ve'ahavta l're'echa. Love your broken piece like you love yourself. You're one big soul. So we look like we're separate from each other. We all have our own skin packaging. But the truth is we are one soul. How cool is that, right? So, with that in mind, let's look back at our blue sheet. Yeah?
Like in the marriage, I said your grandma, but she's still alive.
Yeah, you still can. You definitely can. Yeah, you can daven for her. You can do things in her merit.
That's better.
For sure. And we do that, for instance, when somebody's sick. We don't often do it when somebody is healthy and things are going well. But certainly when somebody's sick, people will take on to guard their tongue, you know, an hour in rotation so that the whole day is covered in the merit of a sick person. Or somebody's having a hard time conceiving. Something that we do often today is 40 people take challah on one day for the merit of that person to conceive. Right? So we do have community projects where we try to generate merit for somebody else to accomplish something physically or spiritually. So we do have that.
Sorry, what does it mean to take challah?
One of the mitzvahs in the Torah is to... One of the concepts in the Torah is to support the Kohanim, the priestly class, whose their job is to connect the Jews with God, right? So their job is not to farm the land. So in connecting the Jews with God, how are they going to eat? So we, the rest of the Jews, take on to feed them. But we don't just take on because sometimes if I volunteer, it doesn't work out so great. So we have a bunch of mitzvahs that help out with that. Tithing our produce and separating a piece of bread from when we make bread, that goes to the Kohen. So today, those mitzvahs don't apply biblically. They apply rabbinically because we don't have a temple standing. We don't have a Kohanic class serving us. But we still practice them so that we'll be in practice. So we don't separate tithes from our produce in this country, outside of the land of Israel. We do separate tithes from our produce inside the land of Israel. We do tithe our money as a concept. But it doesn't have to be the exact tenth. It's a concept. It's not a halacha. But the concept is to keep us giving and to keep us in practice of tithing. But challah, when we make bread that has a certain amount, we separate off a small piece. Today, we don't give it to the Kohen. We burn it. It has holiness. Nobody can eat it. A Kohen's not in a state of holiness that even if you would know a Kohen, you could give it to him to eat. He can't. But we still separate it to keep ourselves in practice of this mitzvah. So when we make a dough that includes more than 8 cups plus of flour, you separate a little piece. Once you get up to 16 cups plus of flour, you separate that little piece and make a blessing. Actually, you do the opposite. You make the blessing first, then you separate the piece. Double wrap it or burn it and discard it. So that's called taking challah. So the challah is that first piece of the dough. Now, that's an interesting thing because challah is the first piece of the dough. And we know that the tail follows the head. So the first piece of the dough, which is called the reshit of the dough, the rosh of the dough, right? That first piece goes to sustain the spiritual connectors, which means then that the rest of the dough should sustain us in being spiritually connected. So it elevates all the food in our lives to food of spiritual connection rather than just physicality.
So a lot of kosher for Passover food says challah is taken?
Challah has been taken. That's correct.
It's the same concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so challah is whenever you have an amount of flour, so it's about flour, 8 cups or more, then you have to take challah from that. So that you can't eat it until you do. So even if you baked it and you forgot, you have to now separate it from the baked product before you can eat it. So that's why it would say challah has been taken. Because there's even a concept that, let's say you make muffins and you make muffins and you have 2 cups in yours and 2 cups in yours and 2 cups in yours. We have a bake sale. We put it all together on the table and now we have 20 cups of flour represented on the table that it could all add together, and we have to take a half a muffin from the table and double wrap it and take challah from all that stuff. So you want to know challah has been taken so that that amount of what's in that box doesn't add up with anything else that you own to require you taking challah from it. Okay, sure. Yes?
So in order to get to Olam Haba, as we said, you have to have your connection with God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you do mitzvahs in this world, those mitzvahs that make the world better, Habitat for Humanity, and you're doing that your whole life, but you're agnostic,
mm-hmm.
and you don't believe in God. So mm-hmm. you go up to the world of souls, and hopefully you've earned, you don't have a relationship with God. You never create a relationship.
Okay, so let's back up. What is Olam Haba? Is it a place? I mean, we tell jokes all the time. You know the story, did I tell the story about the Hadassah ladies in this? Okay, so, you know, there's a bus full of Hadassah ladies, okay? So they're chugging along, going somewhere, and 30 Hadassah ladies on the bus, it goes off a cliff, and they all die. They go up to heaven. An angel standing at the gate says, I'm sorry, I don't see you on the list. You can't go in. And they say, what? We're the Hadassah ladies. What do you mean we can't go in? We're the Hadassah ladies. He says, I don't see you on the list. You can't go in. He says, you got to go downstairs. So they leave. They go downstairs. A few minutes later, the front desk phone rings. God's calling and says, Nu, where are the Hadassah ladies? And the angel says, what do you mean Hadassah ladies? They weren't on the list. I don't have any Hadassah ladies. Hadassah ladies came, but I sent them downstairs. They weren't on the list. God said, didn't you get the revised list? The Hadassah ladies, they belong here. Call downstairs right away and get them back. So the angel's all nervous and calls downstairs and he speaks to the devil and he says, you know that bustle of the Hadassah ladies you got? The devil says, yeah. He says, I need them back. They belong up here. And the devil says, no way. They've been here for less than 24 hours and already they raised enough money for air conditioning. Okay, so we tell jokes like that. It's part of our culture. And yet, we don't actually believe there is a place called heaven or a place called hell. It doesn't exist. So I'll tell you how it exists, but first let's just move down this page quickly to learning from a mashal or a parable. Okay? So, because I'm going to tell you a mashal. So I want to get this concept. When we hear a parable, we know this, but I just want to make sure that we know this. When we hear a parable, we are not listening to the words and the story. We are learning the concept that the story conveys. Okay, so I told you a joke. Instead of just telling you, we think about the place of heaven and we think about a place of hell, I told you a joke so that you have clear in your mind that that is how we believe. That's just kind of how we walk through life. We haven't really considered it. And yet, now I'm going to tell you a mashal to help you understand how we actually see heaven and hell. Okay? The next world, what is it? It's for sure not a place. That's one thing we know 100% because we're not physical in the next world. So there can't be a place that we go to. There's no getting into heaven by the skin of your teeth, right? And there's no burning in fires because that's physical. It's not a physical experience. So where are we headed? We definitely know there's a next world, but what is it like? So here's a parable. Imagine Club Med. I've never been there, but Club Med, right? So you're disconnected for a week. You're on an island where there's no phone service, there's no television in your room, there's no email, no internet, because their goal is for you to have a vacation for a week. You should be disconnected from everything. So you just won 3 weeks with your spouse to Club Med.
It's like Shabbos.
Right? It's like Shabbos, right? You're 3 weeks with your spouse and Club Med, except for in this vacation spot, there's nobody else there. It's just you and your spouse, right? And the servants will take care of you. They'll do your cooking for you, clean up after you. So you have a lovely time, right? It's just so if you, it's just you, your kids are taken care of, your responsibilities are taken care of, there's nothing to worry about. It's just you and your spouse, okay? If you have a great relationship with your spouse, you're in heaven. It's fabulous. You are just basking in the glow of the person you love the most in the world. There's nothing else to think about. No cooking, no cleaning, no tidying, no ordering, nothing. Just you and your spouse. It's fabulous. But if you have a bad relationship, you're in hell because there are no distractions. There's no cooking or cleaning or taking care of kids or business. Nothing. It's just you and your spouse with no distractions for 3 weeks. So the quality of the experience depends 100% on the quality of the relationship. Olam Haba is our living in the relationship that we created with God here. That's it. There is no place. There are no rolling hills, and there's no saints sitting around tables eating Leviathan. You know, all those stories that we hear are all parables. They're all to help us understand a concept from it. But there is no place. There can't be because we're not physical. So it's all spiritual. It's all about the relationship. So it is exactly like Shabbos, except for Shabbos we don't experience 100% like that. So Shabbos is a place, Shabbos is meant to teach us about Olam Haba. We call it a taste of Olam Haba. Why is it a taste of Olam Haba? Because it's pleasant. Because the food is yummy, because the clothes are nice, because the house is tidy, if we've done the work to make that happen. But if we accept Shabbos the way that Shabbos is meant to be, it's a zone in which we can't do anything. We can't create anything. Whatever we accomplish by candlelighting is what we live in. And that's it. You didn't make an extra dessert, you can't make an extra dessert. You didn't clean up the house, you can't clean up the house. You live in what you created. 6 days to create, 1 day to dwell in. And then you get to practice again the next week. 6 days to create, 1 day to dwell in. And there's a cutoff point. Candlelighting is cut off. You're done. It doesn't matter what you've accomplished. When candlelighting comes, you're done. And that's to help us learn about death. When death comes, you're done. It doesn't matter what you still want to accomplish. There is a cutoff point that comes, ready or not. And then you dwell in what you created. You cannot create in the next world. The next world is for dwelling in. This world is for working on. That's why this world is called Aretz, earth, and the next world is called Shemayim, heavens. Aretz, you could also read Arutz, I'm running. It's constant motion all the time. We're always working, working, working. The next world, Shemayim, or Shamim, there. Sham is there. It's there-ness. You're just dwelling. You are there. You're there in whatever relationship you created here. This is the world of creating. That's the world of dwelling. Again, we're not yet there. So even those who have passed away before us are not yet really there yet. Many people are reincarnated in many parts. And many of us are working on different parts. And that's why families also, there's all kinds of different levels of soul. There's a soul in each person. Then there's a soul of a nation. I mean, think about the different flavors that nations have. There is a soul of a nation. Not everybody fits into that soul, but there is a flavor of a nation. There's a spiritual energy of a nation. There's a spiritual energy of a family, right? Where certain families are very generous. Certain families are very kind. Certain families are very stingy, right? And people work out different stuff in their family. That's one reason why we look like people in our family, and why we inherit the stuff in both quotation marks of our family. We get their money or sometimes their debts, right? Although in this country we don't inherit debt. But we get their money and we get the stuff they're still working on. So we have their resources when they die, the stuff that's in their house and the stuff that's in their bank accounts to help finish the process or continue the process of working on the spiritual stuff they've been working on. Because we often inherit that kind of stuff. That's why a good family therapist does a system therapy, where they look a few generations back to see what is going on in this person. Where did it come from? It didn't come from one lifetime alone. So when we talk about souls, we have to get much more sophisticated. We can think about, you know, we give parables, like when we talk about the one soul that's created because God is one and we're created as one, and then it's torn in half and half is sent down into a male and half is sent down into a female, and then you find each other and you're soulmates. Well, yes and no. It's not one soul. It's one soul, and we're all little chips from the one soul. So it's much, 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 much more complicated. You know, and it makes all those questions like, when I'm reincarnated, when I'm resurrected, will I be resurrected as the me that I am today or the me that I was the last lifetime or 20 lifetimes ago? And will I have a relationship with my spouse in the next world that's the spouse of this lifetime or that lifetime? Like, those are questions that are based in a much more simplistic understanding of souls. So I can't answer all those questions for you because the understanding is much more sophisticated. I'm just trying to give you a taste. I don't have a full grasp on the whole thing. I just have enough of a grasp to know it's much more complicated than we understand. There's no simple math for any of this. So, does that help with your where we're headed? So, okay, so now you're an agnostic person. First of all, they're a piece of a soul. And second of all, maybe they did have a thought at some point. And even if they didn't believe in God, it's possible that they might have done something good because it was the right thing to do. So that they used their intellect to override their drive. They might have been thinking, I'd rather sleep in this morning, but the people in New Orleans need a new house. And so I'm volunteering for Habitat for Humanity, and I'm going to get up on time and build a house, not because I believe in God, but because it's the right thing to do to contribute. But that right thing to do, where did that right thing to do concept come from? It really came from religion, which came from God. So maybe they're tapping in somehow. Maybe they're creating a relationship without knowing. Or maybe that gets redeemed later on when they have a thought and all of that then clicks into place and becomes thoughts towards God. But it is, in the end, the relationship that one builds with God that they live in the next world. Sure. Okay. Back to the blue sheet. Now, anybody who's keeping track, and probably none of you are, but you might notice that this week three does not match the week three projected on week one's paper. Week three was supposed to be Hispanus and Hispalus, but I realized maybe we're going a little too fast, so I cut it in half. We're only doing Hispanus this week. How much time do we have? Oh, it's 9:15. Oh, forget it. Okay, so we'll start with this again. Gosh. All right, so this is what we're going to have to do. I'm going to have to, again, leave my double cycles in time in Chedesh and light, fire, and oil for next week. But I just want to do these two concepts. One concept and then a little homework assignment for you. So what we talked about in learning a parable is how to hear the concept with the words conveying the concept, but not to hear the words, right? Heaven is not a Club Med vacation, right? So you shouldn't think that you're being fed food and there's servants taking care of you. Obviously, right? So you have to open up. You have to, that's called laharchiv hadavar. Open the thing up so you can see the big concept in it, right? So I'll just give you two quick examples. I used to let my kids watch little kid videos. Now it's completely out of my control. There's no letting anymore or not letting. But back in the olden days when I was in charge, so I would choose the videos that my kids could watch. One video I did not let them watch was Little Mermaid. And one video that I liked them to watch was Lion King. Why? Because I expanded the concept. So if you know those two stories, quickly you can see Lion King is not a story about lions in the Sahara. It's a story about initially rejecting and then subsequently embracing your heritage, stepping up to greatness, and being part of your tribal carriage of greatness into the future. Being nervous about shouldering that burden, and then taking it on with majesty and stepping forward, right? That's the story of Lion King. So that's opening up the thing. Little Mermaid is a story about marrying out of the fold, disregarding your father, just going with the physical. Kiss the girl. Why not? Marry out of the fold. Don't listen. Step out of your place of birth and origin and go into a different world and completely leave the other one behind. Not a message I wanted my children to be watching again and again. So that those two are examples of how you can open up the thing, right? So we want to learn how to open up the thing. So in case anybody wants to, in the car on the way home, talk to who they're driving with or do this on their own while they're falling asleep tonight, here is a place for you to work on expanding concepts and to work on this verbal introspection. I just put some questions at the bottom. What is unique about my seichel? You just ask that question and then answer it to yourself. You know, and you can answer it in different ways, but you can start with, what's unique about my seichel is that I'm a human being and I'm the only creature on the planet that has a seichel like this. My seichel is the conduit for a relationship with Torah and Hashem. So you just start answering that question, what is unique about it, and then try to open it up. What is seichel for me? Maybe then what's unique about my seichel as opposed to your seichel? So depending on how far you want to go with that, but what is unique about my seichel? How can I expand the concept? So that might be about seichel, it might be about the concept of expanding the concept. And then here is a concept that you can expand on. We read this section, how is Torah like an ember? Right? So it says right there, you don't even have to think that much about it, but you might want to just re-say what we said about Torah being like an ember. It can look cold and dark when it's not worked with, but when you work with it, when you put your soul into it, when you breathe on it, when you turn it over, it comes to life. And there's so many different shades, but if you never do that, it looks dead. Right, so you might want to talk about why is Torah, how is Torah like an ember? How are Ratzon and Yetzer related? How are Torah and Seichel related? So these are just questions. You could do one, you could do all, you could do none, but you could practice the verbal introspection technique with any one of these just so you get kind of an idea of what that is, of opening up the thing. And B'ezrat Hashem will continue next week with half of this and some more.